mouth.
Word of 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 mouth.
Word of
mouth. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's easy to tell the villain in an old Western. The good guy wears a white hat, and the bad guy wears black. Real-life villains don't follow the code, nor are they likely to conspicuously twirl their mustaches like Snidely Whiplash awaiting the oncoming train. Sure, Hitler was evil, but what is the nature of villainy? Bill Clinton, Joe Frazier, and the Sharon Stone character in Basic Instinct each attract haters. But does that make them wicked? Why does Taylor Swift inspire cultish adoration while Wilt Chamberlain is loathed? Chuck Klosterman writes about sports and popular culture and is the New York Times ethicist. He explores the nature of badness, in a bad way, in a new collection of essays called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains, Real and Imagined. Chuck Klosterman, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here.
You define villainy early in the book as the person who knows the most but cares the least. Tell us what you mean by that.
First of all, when you're trying to write a book like this, when you're kind of working through ideas that are very conceptual, you're always looking for like a unifying field theory. And the closest I come is this idea that the villain is the person who knows the most and cares the least. Now, this is not perfect. There are certainly exceptions to this, some very meaningful. I mean, Hitler is a meaningful exception. Hitler is not someone who knew the most and cared the least. He cared about everything and didn't know anything. But for the most part, you know, what really bothers people is the idea of somebody who just has no emotional investment in what they're doing and yet is sort of effortlessly skilled at manipulating people or sort of controlling society or attaining whatever success that they want. I saw a documentary the other night on Lee Atwater.
Uh-huh.
I really wished I'd written about him because he's almost a perfect example of this. You know, he's this guy who was the architect of the Republican Party through the 70s and 80s and early 90s, did a lot of sort of diabolical things.
He was the Willie – he came up with the Willie Horton campaign, right?
He came up with the Willie Horton campaign. He would sometimes just blatantly lie about people's like – past mental illness or whatnot, you know, a lot of problematic things that within the context of politics were not only acceptable but very successful. But the most interesting thing about this guy to me is that he became a Republican arbitrarily. When he was a young man, he knew he was interested in politics and just saw more traction on the conservative side of the spectrum. If it had been reversed, if the nature of America had been different, he would have become, you know, a Democrat. And to me, that's like the ultimate manifestation of this kind of theory, the idea that this person who understood politics so well, he knew he could succeed and yet had no interest in really being gauged what that success meant.
And they're the people with the kind of swagger. I mean, Lee Atwater is a really great example of it. There's a kind of cynicism in choosing sides just based on what he thinks he can get out of it. And there's a special attention that you pay to those who aspire to villainy, the Aleister Crowleys, and the late 1980s hip-hop band N.W.A., whose real name and most famous song we can't say on the radio.
You know, there is a difference, though, between like an Aleister Crowley character and N.W.A. The fact of the matter is Aleister Crowley actually believed he had to do all these evil things in order to, I guess, be authentically villainous. Like, you know, when he was a young boy, he once killed a cat in 9 different ways, the same cat, just to test the theory of does a cat really have 9 lives? You know, he believed he had to eat all the drugs. He believed he had to push his mother-in-law down a flight of stairs because she represented this idea, this concept that he had to be against. What's different with N.W.A. or, say, the Oakland Raiders of the 1970s or perhaps even someone like Andrew Dice Clay is that they aspired to have the perception of villainy. They saw the kind of the utility in being against whatever the culture was. It's, you know, it's very strange because when someone is a villain on purpose, people don't really believe them. They see it more like a theatrical move.
It works in some places, I guess, in others. And that's one of the things I kind of took away from this book, that a Muhammad Ali, for example, he comes away as the sort of beloved character, while Joe Frazier, who worked himself up from, what, the cotton field, becomes the despised one. Why so fickle?
Well, you know, it's really like a good question. Can I totally explain it? I can't, but I find it very fascinating. I find it fascinating that Muhammad Ali, during his kind of three defining fights against Frazier, used incredible racist language against Frazier and basically positioned him as a black fighter fighting for white America. With Ali, it's particularly complicated because outside of this window, he's probably the most important athlete of the 20th century in terms of race relations. So then it becomes a question of, are we trying to look at someone in totality and trying to go, well, okay, most of what they did was good. They did this one terrible thing. Can we excuse that? But it goes further with figures who are sort of this towering in the culture. Muhammad Ali, I almost compare a little bit to John Lennon. John Lennon has a real problematic history with women. I mean, his own kids have talked about remembering John Lennon hitting his wives, you know. But as a Beatles fan, and I'm one of these people, it's almost like we don't want that to even be part of the story. You know, with Ali, I think part of it had to do with his pure confidence, sort of his unadulterated bravado that forced those around him to sort of accept that, well, he's a progressive no matter what he says. You know, no matter what the message seems to be content-wise, we know as a figure he is the progressive. And over time, the progressives always succeed because, you know, the culture evolves too. And anybody with progressive ideas, no matter how strange they may seem at the time, are eventually going to seem completely valid.
Chuck Klosterman is with us, and he's talking about his new collection of essays called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains, Real and Imagined. Well, you know, not to mention that Muhammad Ali is an attractive man, and there is something that you point out here that a lot of Bernard Goetz, for example, who was for about 5 minutes, you know, a hero, the subway vigilante who shot four youths on a subway train in New York in the 1970s, doesn't make out so well being a weird looking guy. Linda Tripp, obviously, doesn't make out so well not being a very attractive person through no fault of her own. But how much do looks have to do with the perceived villainy?
Well, you know, I'm probably especially sensitive to this because I'm a very weird-looking person. And I think that if you're a weird-looking person, the understanding of how much handsomeness and sexuality plays in interpersonal culture is really maybe amplified. I have an essay in this book where I'm talking about, you know, the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky situation. Mm-hmm. It would be very easy, I think, to say like, well, you know, why was Bill Clinton able to sort of have this event happen in his life, basically be the world's most famous philanderer for a period of time? He really, you know, in a weird way, you know, put the presidency at risk for this kind of one desire that he, again, had no emotional investment in. And of course, the first response somebody will have to that is, well, you know, that's just this double standard we have that men can get away with this and women can't, you know. And there's certainly some truth in that, but the attractiveness of Bill Clinton was a role in this as well. I don't think Nixon would be allowed to have had that kind of experience and been re-embraced not just by America as a whole, but specifically by women. That Christmas, he had the highest approval rating of his entire tenure as president.
Well, in addition to being a slightly weird looking, or let's just say a person who didn't care very much about his appearance, I'm going back to Bernard Goetz, just because he talked, he filled himself out as a person. He let us know who he was and what his motivations were, which really turned everybody off. And you make that point here. It's the people who talk. It's the Wilt Chamberlain who talks about himself. It's Linda Tripp who decides to talk about herself. Is it better just to stay silent, to keep a heroic kind of poise?
You know, the silence is part of it, certainly, but it's almost even a larger abstraction. It's the idea that people don't know anything about you, so they can fill you kind of with whatever their pre-existing desire happens to be. You know, Bernard Goetz shoots people on a subway. Okay, initially, if you go up to anyone who's intellectual, somebody who has, a supposedly sophisticated view of culture and say, like, is vigilante justice acceptable? They will say no. You know, of course not. We have a framework for this. People need due process. You cannot allow an individual to decide what justice is. But then you give them a situation without many details. All you know is that there's this person in a city filled with crime, bothering no one, confronted by three potential criminals, and he kind of responds with violence. When that's all the information we have, it almost seems like he is acting as an agent for society, or maybe that he's making, you know, the world safer by, you know, shooting people in public. It seems paradoxical, but that's the initial sense of Bernard Goetz. The first 48 to 72 hours of those shootings, you really couldn't find anybody who had a problem with him. It was like he was an unknown hero. But once he comes forward and he says things like, I wanted to kill those guys. Shooting them was easier than typing. We start learning details about things he said at a community meeting that were potentially racist. We find these bizarre things about his life. For example, he still lives in New York in an apartment with squirrels in it because he's a big advocate for squirrels, you know. We learn all these sort of interesting details about him, but what that does is it makes his actions now seem personal. He no longer seems like he's an agent for society. He seems like an agent for himself. And that forces everyone to swing back to the original idea that you just can't let the lone gunman decide what is right and what is wrong.
You make the point in the book that we say thank you to the convenience store clerk so that we can be seen as the kind of people who say thank you, right? We're invested in people knowing what we like or dislike. So how much of the hero and the villain is a projection of how we want to be seen?
Oh, I think certainly almost all of it. This book is like all of my kind of essay collections. It's not as though I'm trying to persuade people to believe a certain thing about villains or heroes or anything. I'm not like that. I know that's kind of antithetical to criticism in some ways, but I have no desire to be like a tastemaker or to shape public opinion. I'm trying to explore these things on my own. Like something's interesting in my life, and I feel like the best way for me to kind of work through my consciousness is kind of through writing about it. So, you know, a lot of this book has to do with my own fear that I am a bad person regardless of what I do. So a lot of what I think about in this book is not even what happened, but why it happened to begin with. Like, what was the intent? And then how is that intent sort of manipulated by the audience?
Okay, so how about just a quick little quiz? I'm going to ask you who is more villain.
Okay.
Taylor Swift or Eazy-E?
Well, Eazy-E is trying to project the image of badness. It is a conscious construction. Taylor Swift is attempting to create the illusion of purity. I would say Taylor Swift is probably closer to an actual villain than Eazy-E.
Okay, Julian Assange or Darth Vader?
Well, Julian Assange is absolutely convinced that what he is doing is more moral than what the mainstream media does. He is very much a believer that if you put information out, even if it harms one person or 10 people or 100 people, there's a value to that if it ends up saving the lives or transforming the lives of a million people. Darth Vader blew up planets arbitrarily. So I guess Darth Vader is more of a villain.
Okay. How about Don Henley or Snidely Whiplash?
Okay. That's a good one. Snidely Whiplash had a compulsion. He could not stop himself from tying women to railroad tracks for no reason whatsoever. He just seemed to like to do it. Don Henley really liked to make money. He wanted to take it easy. I mean, the thing is, if Snidely Whiplash, I guess, isn't a villain, no one is, right? I mean, it's sort of like he's based on the archetype of the silent movie villain. The cover of the book is essentially his outfit. So I guess I will go with Snidely Whiplash, which I guess is sort of an interesting compliment to the Eagles.
Chuck Klosterman, I want to thank you so much for straightening those out for us. I think it's better that people know.
Yeah, good. Okay, well, I try to contribute something to society.
You can can find out more about Chuck Klosterman's new collection of essays. It's called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains. We have a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Long lines are part of life for most of us. At the DMV, the grocery store, the post office, we line up by choice for some things. Maybe you've heard of people queuing up for hours outside the New York City bakery that sells the Cronut. Francesca Gino wrote about new research suggesting that one reason we're willing to wait in long lines for midnight movies or the latest smartphone or bizarre baked delicacies is because they help us learn something about ourselves. Francesca is a behavioral scientist and associate professor at Harvard Business School. She wrote about the psychology of waiting in line for Fast Company and joins us now. Francesca, welcome to Word of Mouth.
It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, so the Cronut craze hasn't really hit New Hampshire. We're still catching up on cupcakes and frozen yogurt. Can you tell us what a Cronut is?
A Cronut is something in between a donut and a croissant. And here you have the name Cronut. And I'm still waiting for mine, by the way. So I'm going to New York next week, and I'm going to be in line for a long time waiting for mine.
A long time. I hear that the suggestion is the bakery opens at 8. People line up 2 hours before for this cross between a croissant and donut. Plenty of reports of scalpers selling the pastries for $30 markups. So, Francesca, first, do long lines actually help boost business for these type of products?
In situations like this, they do. Standing in line actually signals something to ourselves about the importance of actually the product that we're going to eat, but also signal something to others. By seeing such long lines, you're going to think that the product is very, very popular, and you might be wondering whether you should be in line yourself.
Self-signaling. Can you tell us more about what that means?
Yes, we are strange creatures when it comes to our thinking and behavior. Self-signaling is a part of behavior, is a theory actually in psychology that suggests that oftentimes we look at our behavior to understand something about ourselves. So, for example, you might imagine seeing a beggar on the street and giving a dollar or two for coffee to this person and looking at the behavior and basically translating into, I'm such a good person. I'm such a wonderful human being that always give money to others. So we take every simple behavior that we might engage in and we use it to understand something or to signal something to ourselves, in this particular case that we care about other people and that we are generous towards others.
I wonder if there's an idea here that we are signaling we're worth this. I mean, is it a way of sort of affirming one's value to think, I'm worth getting in on this craze. I am worth waiting for something that I deserve.
That's certainly a wonderful possibility. It's interesting. I got started thinking about these long lines and self-signaling more carefully after I was working for Disney in the summer of 2010. And one of the research director there at the time, Joe Marks, had a beautiful story about long lines at the parks. He had visited Tokyo, and what he noticed is that there were long lines forming in front of a shop that was producing leather bracelets that were about $10 a piece. And thinking from the mindset of a person who tends to be more rational and knows the principle of economics, he actually went to the management there and said, I think you should open up another store. People might not enjoy waiting in line for such a long time for a bracelet. And instead, what he discovered is, again, signaling was at work. In that particular case, the bracelet had a meaning of a commitment to a relationship, according to some beliefs in Japan. And what is interesting is that people were standing in line with their partner or spouse, and so the standing meant signaling to the other person that you really, really cared about the relationship. So this was another case where actually having long lines was strategically valuable to Disney and to the stores in their parks.
So if I were a marketer and trying to make my product look pretty exclusive, maybe you can just hire a line full of people to make it look like something you'd want to join.
I'm pretty sure that some marketers are already doing this.
Well, Francesca, I want to thank you for joining us today.
It was such a pleasure to join you.
Francesca Gino, an author, behavioral scientist, and associate professor at the Harvard Business School. You'll find a link to her article and instructions on how to get in on the cronut craze at wordofmouthradio.org. Oh, and enjoy your cronut next week.
Thank you. I will let you know how it goes.
With us for the weirdest procedure that won't happen anytime soon, we're going to get a reality check on a surgeon's bold claim that the technology for performing a human head transplant is well on its way. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1970, Dr. Robert White attempted an experimental surgical procedure that could have been lifted from the pages of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. He removed the head of one living monkey and attached it to the body of another. Dr. White called it a head transplant and a success. His detractors called it a medical and ethical nightmare. In June of this year, Italian surgeon Sergio Canavero declared that advances in medical technology have made head transplants possible again. A number of medical professionals greeted his announcement with skepticism. The Atlantic's health editor, James Hamlin, wrote about how Canavero says the procedure will work. And James, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So first off, you chose the perspective of body transplant instead of head transplant. Why is that?
Well, if we consider Rene Descartes' I think, therefore I am, then your identity is most closely tied to your mind, which would be your brain.
So that's where consciousness, memory, identity lives, or solely resides as far as we know.
That's the traditional thought. A counterintuitive perspective might be that if these transplanted bodies were to reproduce, the child would carry the DNA of the body rather than the head.
Uh-huh. So, you know, we're not talking about brain transplants. We're talking about full heads, which means obviously having to link everything that attaches the head to the body.
Yes. So that would include the carotid arteries, the trachea, the esophagus, the spinal cord, all the muscles, everything.
Tell us more about Dr. White's trials on monkeys in the 1970s. What worked, what didn't?
There are differing accounts as to how successful it was, but the facts, as they seem to be agreed upon, is that the monkey lived for about 8 days, was sort of in and out of consciousness, was able to make facial expressions and interact in a way that did seem meaningful to some. It seemed to be expressing pain, and it remained paralyzed from the neck down, so they were not able to successfully connect the spinal cord.
Okay, so now in 2013, this Italian surgeon says, no, we figured it out. This is how we do it. What would have to happen, according to him, for a body transplant to be successful?
Well, this is really contingent on being able to fuse a severed spinal cord, which he believes is more possible than it was then because of recent advancements in stem cell technology and also in some polyethylene glycol injections that have been used around severed spinal cords in lab animals. But the differences remain that this has only been done with any degree that could be considered success in one animal who's had its spinal cord severed and refused, not in an animal and another animal being connected.
And you kind of spell this out for us as requiring two surgeries, two technical teams. The head would have to be put into a hypothermic state and cooled to a temperature that so you could work on it. And all the work would have to be done in 1 hour. So how far away are we from a procedure like this?
I would defer to Dr. Jerry Silver, who's a neurosurgeon at Case Western, who was actually part of the trials with the monkey that Dr. Robert White did in 1970, and he said that we are light years away. I would agree with that. Mm. It just seems like there are so many barriers to actually doing this, not to mention the $16 million estimated cost.
Well, that's a question, James. I mean, this story got picked up in a lot of different places. And of course, you know, the headline of a head transplant is a big deal. You know, is there damage in sort of advancing the idea of a technology that maybe one doctor champions, others say light years away?
This was really just one doctor making a point known that is integral to his area of research, but that everyone else really understood to be hypothetical. It got a lot of publicity in the media, but if we were to choose to give so much publicity to every obscure journal article that's out there every day, we'd see that there's a lot of crazy stuff like this happening.
Is Sergio Canavero kind of spelled out who the perfect candidate for a head transplant in his terms would be? Who is it?
You would need someone who was young and relatively healthy, didn't have any major systemic disease, but was fully brain dead, which might happen after, say, a car accident. That person would be your body donor. And then for the person who would be to receive the body, that would be someone who did have a systemic disease, say, a cancer that had spread all over the body, but somehow spared the neck, head, and brain. Those two people could theoretically go together, but they would also have to be typed and matched in every way that anyone is when they receive an organ, say, a liver or kidney. He said roughly the same age, roughly the same stature, gender and sex. So there are so many variables there, even if it was possible for this to work timing-wise, to have the person in need and the person available at the same time. That right there is a barrier.
James Hamblin, The Atlantic's health editor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find a link to read James's article, How to Perform a Head Transplant, at wordofmouthradio.org. An agricultural practice dating from the Neolithic period shares a glass with the robotics of the future. The first evidence of grapevine cultivation for wine was about 7,000 years ago, and since then, viticulture has developed a degree of automation. Still, winemakers depend on human hands and eyes to thoroughly and tediously inspect their crop for quality and yield. Researchers at Carnegie Mellon University are developing an automated grape counting system that will help lighten that load and lead to the production of better wine. Sarah Reardon is staff writer and reporter for New Scientist, and she covered the machines that could change the future of winemaking. Sarah, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Sarah, if I'm to understand this correctly, every single grape in a vineyard is counted?
Well, humans don't normally count every grape. Workers in a vineyard will go out and feel through the vines, find clusters of grapes, and then report that back. And there are some other ways as well that vineyard managers can go and get an average of how many grapes might be out there, how large they are, how ripe they are. But this new system, this new computer vision system that the researchers at Carnegie Mellon developed, does count every grape that it can see as it goes up and down the rows.
What's the purpose of counting each grape?
The purpose is to kind of get an idea of how many grapes are out there. You might need to know, for instance, if your grapes are not doing so well, if they're not enough water, there's a lot of pests in an area, you might want to spray pesticide there. And then just kind of get an idea of when you would want to harvest them once they're large enough, once they're ripe enough. Rather than sending people out to all these different parts throughout the vineyard, a robot can just do that for you.
So, Sarah, you actually went through this process at a vineyard in California, was it?
Yes.
So with the scanner, you just drive along and it scans and counts the grapes that quickly?
Yes, it's actually quite fun. We drove kind of fast, and there's the big strobe light that's blinking on top. You have to do it at night because you want to have a constant source of illumination. You don't want the sun changing the shadows on the grapes, would confuse the robot. So they have a strobe light blinking very quickly that will illuminate the grapes briefly, let the camera take an image as you drive along. Yeah, and it, in real time, more or less, pops up on the screen all of the photos that it's taking, very high resolution. And then later on, the researchers can go through and have the robot do statistics on how many grapes are actually out there.
Wow. So, you know, often when we hear about robots, we think of sort of humanoid-looking forms. What does this robot actually look like?
Well, right now, this was more of a computer vision system than a robot. It just interprets what it sees. But at Carnegie Mellon, they're also developing a lot of self-driving vehicles that can be used for all different types of agriculture and for orchards as well. So I think that these researchers eventually would like to mount this camera onto a self-driving robot and just send it out there at night and everybody else can go home.
So besides getting a sort of scan of the grapes, given that it's a computer, is there any other information that it's recording? Anything else it can tell about the growing of the grapes?
Yeah, it's got two different systems going on at the same time. One is counting the grapes with a camera, and the other one is a 3D laser scanner that's measuring the plants themselves, the vines, how large they are, how much canopy there is, shading them from the sun, because it's very sunny out there in the agricultural areas of Central California, so they want to have some amount of shade over the grapes, but not too much, because you have to have some sun for the grapes to really develop their full flavor and color. And so what this 3D laser scanner then does is measure the ratio of the canopy to the number of grapes that are there, and then helps you know, should you be out there trimming down the canopy, should you be letting it grow some more to try and get the optimal amount of shade on your grapes.
Well, you're talking about a really precise, and this is part of a growing field of data-driven precision agriculture that we're seeing more and more of. What kind of development or growth do you anticipate in the field of automated agriculture, Sarah?
Well, I think that there are quite a few people very interested in this area, and I know that the National Grape and Wine Industry is investing in this type of technology because it will be so useful for growers. There's other groups that are developing automated systems that could spray pesticide on its own, could harvest apples on its own. There's robotic hands being developed that could reach out and pick apples for you. And there's other systems, too, that can sense whether a field is being watered enough, whether it's getting enough light, and then control certain parameters automatically or at least let the orchard owners know what they should be doing.
I'm thinking that part of the selling point for wine is this kind of idea of working within a tradition and individual care. Do you think if consumers were to see the photograph of a four-wheeler driving around with basically a camera and scanner on it, that would destroy some of the romanticism of viticulture?
To some people it might. Others would just be happier to have a better wine that could eventually even be cheaper, possibly. But already so much of our agriculture is done by machines. This is really no different than having a tractor at all. I mean, this is just how modern farming is right now.
Sarah Reardon is a staff writer and reporter for New Scientist. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find a link to her article on the Days of Wine and Robots at wordofmouthradio.org. Moonshine has been making its way back into the market, thanks in no small part to the Discovery Channel's popular reality show, Moonshiners.
Yeah, I've made all kinds of liquor in my time. I've made the fighting kind, the loving kind, the crying kind. I even made some one time and sold it to this couple. They was happily married. The next damn week, they're divorced.
While the roots of White Lightning may be in southern Appalachia, there's at least one illegal operation brewing in the deep shade of the New Hampshire forest. That's what NHPR's Todd Bookman found. He brings us this report for Foodstuffs, NHPR's series on local foods.
These woods are better known for running sap than a still, but in an unnamed forest, $200 worth of copper, shaped and soldered, is quietly being assembled.
Filling this up, and we'll get the heat on and start going. Take a little while to warm up. You want to do it slow so you don't burn it.
This is, of course, illegal in New Hampshire, 49 other states too, so anonymity is required.
You call me Hoss. Hoss works.
Dressed in the official outfit of overalls minus an undershirt, Hoss and some friends look the part of accomplished amateurs. For them, this is more pastime than business.
I like just like hanging out. It's something we all have in common that we can just do and hang out, especially when it's nice out like this. Hang out down in the woods, make a fire, drink some beers, you know. It's fun. Make a little money, you know. Nothing wrong with that, right?
Along with the modest income, passion for moonshining fills a small gap in Haas's life.
Yeah, you know. You know, here and there, you know, it is what it is, you know. I like the ladies, you know. Don't have a particular girlfriend right now, but...
Haas is a bit of a hardened character, with both a lip full of tobacco and a lit cigarette dangling from his mouth. He does have his recipe down, though. The mash, the raw ingredient of moonshine, has been fermenting for about 2 weeks. It's amber, with diced apples and pears added for flavor. Haas pours it into the 60-gallon still, a roaring flame going underneath the copper.
And that's heating that up inside of the tank and filling up this cap with the vapors.
Once it reaches 170 degrees, the vapors will push through a pipe into the thumper, a small container that filters and purifies and thumps. The steam next travels down a coiled length of copper known as the worm.
The worm is filled with cold water, and once those vapors travel through that worm, through the cold water, they come out this as moonshine. And that's pretty much it.
This whole process, the heating, thumping, condensing, takes an afternoon, during which burgers get cooked, beers drunk. There's no sense of urgency or heightened secrecy to the affair.
It's low-key up here. I don't think anybody really knows what's going on with it, how to look for it, or what to even look for. I mean, I wouldn't even know before, you know? So I don't know. Just got to worry about nosy people, I guess. That's about it.
I can tell you that we do not patrol the forest.
Scott Dunn with the New Hampshire Liquor Commission says there are no current investigations into moonshining in the state, and none in recent memory.
I would say that any case of moonshining, could be a potential health hazard and therefore does become an issue.
Health hazards from its high alcohol content. Haas also recognizes the moral hazards of consumption.
No, I don't support people drinking and driving. I don't support people, getting trashed and doing stupid things that hurt other people, anything like that. I want people to enjoy it. I want people to respect it. I want people to be responsible, for sure.
An unlabeled jar slowly fills with 150-proof clear liquid. Small sips are advised.
Ooh. 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 Rugged.
If these tasting notes don't turn you off, Haas and his friends may be willing to sell you a jug. But that's only if you can find them. They're not planning any marketing campaigns.
I don't want to be necessarily known for moonshine. I just want people to like it. Like, I've heard a couple stories like, oh, man, we got some moonshine, blah, blah. It was so good. And they had no idea that they were talking to the person that made it. And it made me feel good. You know what I mean? Like, it felt good. Because I know where they got it, you know?
Way up on Clinch Mountain, I wander alone. I'm drunk as the devil, just leave me alone. Oh, whiskey, rye, whiskey, it's whiskey, I cry. If you don't give me rye whiskey, I surely will die.
Thanks to Todd Bookman for that. And you can find more on NHPR's local food series, Foodstuffs, at nhpr.org.
If a tree don't fall on me, I'll live till I die. Rye whiskey, rye whiskey, whiskey I cry. If you don't give me rye whiskey, I surely will die.
Now stay with us after a short break. We're going to sit down with a pair of food bloggers that goes by the name Hot Knives about putting the edge back in vegetarian food. Their new cookbook, Lust for Leaf, is made to rage. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
If you don't give me rye whiskey, I surely will die.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Parties don't throw themselves. That's the opening sentiment of a new cookbook that turns vegetarian fare on its ponytailed head. Lust for Leaf is the brainchild of a pair of L.A.-based food bloggers behind the site Hot Knives, who describe themselves as bearded, mezcal-swilling Martha Stewarts. Alex Brown is general manager for Gourmet Imports and connoisseur of obscure cheese and craft beer. Alex, hello and welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having us.
And Evan George, former sous chef turned public radio producer at KCRW in Santa Monica. Evan, welcome.
Thanks, Virginia.
Well, there are more words that I cannot say on the radio in this than any other cookbook I've ever read. So I'm wondering if cookbook is really the right description for Lust for Leaf.
This book is actually quite toned down from our first in terms of four-letter words.
Absolutely. It definitely took some exercising of restraint. But there's definitely plenty of really, really gross descriptions of things.
Well, that's really appetizing for a cookbook. But I was going to suggest it's more like it's more of a like how-to or lifestyle book, making the point that parties don't happen on their own. They require planning and preparation. So what are you guys? You're holding our hands through this whole thing?
Ideally, yes. but we don't take anything too explicitly or literally. I mean, you could definitely pick up the book and plan any number of specific parties that we set out to plan. But you could also just pick and choose from the book and, you know, make something small and sweet for yourself or for your friends.
At some point, we decided that it might be a good idea to put a charcoal grill right next to a swimming pool and throw a party that way. I'm not sure other people would agree, but if they do, then there's an instruction for how to have that party.
You know, there's also a sort of rambunctious video with a lot of really gorgeous-looking people eating really gorgeous-looking food. I guess is that how you live out there in Los Angeles?
Those are real people. In fact, they are real friends of ours. And the food is real. I mean, we really sort of, we wanted to avoid cooking a lot of food, setting it in a test kitchen, and photographing it like it's a piece of art. We wanted to make it for actual parties, invite people over that we would be probably partying with that summer anyway, and shoot them literally eating it. And it made for a different kind of experience for us and for them, obviously.
Well, that's something that I found kind of funny, because you think, I mean, one thing's, come on over for a vegetarian barbecue or picnic. It may not sound like the most exciting, or I don't know. I guess those kind of images of the enchanted broccoli forest come up for me in that case. You know, people who are kind of health conscious, and this book is not full on health conscious. I mean, you've got a potato salad that creates crushed Doritos and cheese made from beer. I'm guessing that might not make it in the Moosewood Cookbook.
There's a lot of, like, unfortunate generalizations that we had to sublimate, you know, to move forward as a people. Vegetarian food being, like, boring and healthy and, like, tepid and lame is, you know, that's something that, if anything, is our modus operandi, it's that, the sublimation of those ideas.
Our publisher actually asked us at one point, are you sure you want to have this Dorito salad in the book? But just the way we've served it the last couple of times, because essentially what you're doing is you're crushing up Doritos, coating pan-fried potatoes with them, and then tossing that in yogurt and mayonnaise. It is not healthy by any stretch of the imagination, but the look on people's faces when you bring them a bag of Doritos, they peel it back, and it's potato salad, is worth whatever ill effects it's going to have on all of our health.
Potatoes are also fried in butter, too.
Well, I'm also imagining a kind of, you know, similar experience when somebody bites into one of your power bars and there's a pickle, chopped up pickle in it. I mean, is this, how do you guys think these things up? Do you experiment with them on all of your friends? What's happening?
Peanut butter and pickles is sort of a flavor combination that's sort of like become classic in our eyes. And that's more born out of like college dormitory boredom food. You know, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich is, you know, it's got that sweet and savory thing going on, but we've always been like savory on savory kind of guys. And sometimes that sounds a little unsavory, but peanut butter and pickles is awesome. And it kind of like brings in Southeast Asian kind of flavor sensibility with this, like, I don't know really where it came from. We thought it was like funny to make sandwiches that only pregnant ladies would want to eat.
Now, Evan, I'm also noticing here some creative twists on traditional party appetizers. Tell us a little bit about the jackfruit carnitas. Carnitas, which I guess is usually, what, roast pork in the oven, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Several years ago, we started finding in some of the sort of off-the-beaten-path vegetarian restaurants that jackfruit was showing up a lot. We actually had a friend who was a chef of one of these establishments, and so we picked his brain, you know, this stuff. In this case, it was a jackfruit barbecue pulled pork sandwich, and they were using sort of crappy barbecue sauce, and they were cutting all sorts of corners, but the jackfruit itself was amazing. And so we sort of sat him down and interrogated him over beers at one point, and he told us the particular Indonesian market where he goes, the brand of canned jackfruit that he uses. You want to get them in brine and not sugar syrup. Very important, which we found out. Playing with that as something that will absorb summer sauces, and you can make tacos with it, you can make sliders. It's the type of ingredient that we sort of got obsessed with in this summer of partying.
We're talking about vegetarian party food on a whole new level, and my guests are Alex Brown and Evan George, the food blogging duo behind Hot Knives, most definitely not on the paleo diet. Their new project is the recipe and how-to party book. It's called Lust for Leaf. Well, you write in the beginning of the book that hardwired, we have this deep craving for communal consumption. So, but if you're talking cave people, weren't they also hardwired to look for meat? And yet you offer them what? Protein? What does that mean?
Protein is our way of approaching fake meats that won't make non-vegetarians turn off a part of their brain. So it's our take on hot dogs, where you're pulsing up spices and soy and a little bit of beer, and we swear it will smell like Hebrew nationals when you take the top off the blender. We also have done 3 times fried oyster mushroom sandwiches, which is sort of not your typical fake meat, but we've become obsessed with mushrooms as meat.
You guys are savory unsavory guys, but there is also room for sweets here. Maybe let's talk about some of the unique sorbet recipes. Who wants to pick that up? Alex or Evan, you want to describe a few?
Desserts in general, we've always sort of shied away from them. And there's a cross-cultural sort of fear. If you are a savory cook, then, you know, you cannot, it is impossible to make sweet things. It's like an unknown alchemy. And, you know, this was, again, chicken and egg. You know, we had the food pyramid. There's got to be an ice cream cone on top. So our focus usually is we just go to the farmer's market and we find something we think looks great and we just take it home and mess with it until we find something good. And so for the sorbets, I mean, there's one that's kind of based on like a liquido or like an agua fresca. It's strawberries and jamaica is the only actual quote-unquote fruit-based sorbet. The other two that are in the book are actually made from vegetables. There's one made with Persian cucumbers and another one made with fire-roasted chilies that we call icy hot that was a total, you know, weird, like, brain fart of an idea that totally took the cake. The cucumber sorbet is great. The strawberry jamaica sorbet is great. The icy hot is beautiful. It's amazing.
If you do say so yourself.
Oh, yeah.
Now, not all of the flavors are altogether unfamiliar for those of us who, you know, don't use jamaica on a daily basis, but you do include tarts and fruit salads and a pecan pie. So what is the Hot Knives twist on these traditional foods?
With pies, we definitely sort of steered towards thinking about our main intake of sugar, which is booze. I mean, we're self-described beer geeks, and we love the stronger stuff, too. And so we were thinking about how to sort of make a cocktail in pie form. Instead of just doing a cherry pie, we do a cherry pie that has some Manhattan tendencies. So there's rye whiskey reduced with the cherries, and we actually use Angostura bitters to help sort of perk up the flavor. And the acidity and the bitterness obviously helps you taste everything, but it also, you know, hints at that flavor combination of brandied cherry at the bottom of Manhattan. And for apricots, I mean, this is kind of a shot in the dark, but apricot and tequila or mezcal mix really well together. So for that pie filling, it's basically, you know, a cactus liquor reduction that gives it a really cool kind of backbone.
In fact, I notice here on the bottom of the pyramid, there are a lot of bottles that have 3 X's on them. Well, we also want to mention that this book, besides offering recipes, also offers choices of booze and beer, but also a playlist. So, you know, what do you want to be listening to when you're grilling something? Maybe the Cramps, maybe the Misfits. I don't know. I'm wondering what makes a good vegetarian party mix.
There's nothing specifically vegetarian about our playlist. In fact, I think if you pulled the bands that show up on it, there's probably nary a vegetarian among them. But, you know, we've always paired songs with our food. It's kind of a calling card of ours. And I think what showed up on this book's mix was just songs that had a smoother groove to them, because we think less about what is fun to sing to yourself while you're grilling and more about what do you want to be listening to while you're scarfing food with your closest friends outdoors.
Given this, you know, you wanted to throw it up in the air and make it a little wacky and add some life to this. Are you hoping to build a kind of hard partying vegetarian lifestyle empire? Is this the beginning?
You know, we're more about converting hard partiers over to, you know, maybe cooking something from the book than trying to take softies and get them to party harder.
The book is Lust for Leaf, Veggie Crowd Pleasers to Fuel Your Picnics, Your Potlucks, and Ragers. And it's put together by the food blogging duo behind Hot Knives. Alex Brown, I want to thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And Evan George, thank you so much.
Thank you, Virginia.
You can find links to more on the book, including a really attractive trailer full of really attractive people, and a link to the Hot Knives food blog at wordofmouthradio.org. And you can also share your favorite hard-partying vegetarian recipes on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. Thank you for spending some time with us today. If you like what you heard, please pass it along. You'll find a list of segments at wordofmouthradio.org, and all it takes is a swift click on the Facebook, Twitter, or email icons to share them with friends. Word of Mouth thrives on the world of ideas and submissions from our listeners. We invite you to share stories from off the beaten path, the worthwhile blogs, the interesting reads and events, the kind you'd share with your friends. The best stories are told by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us again for more Word of Mouth next week from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby, Zach Nugent,
and Bill Barry.
And senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with plenty of help from our interns, Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon.
Sarah Plord is our digital producer.
And Dan Colgan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program
are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR, its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast
and listen to past shows, go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr.
Follow us on Twitter.
And check out a playlist of music from the program
on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.